passion, drive, and patience. What brings home the winning trophy is also what keeps your ride or die alive. eBay Motors has everything you need to maintain your vehicle and level it up to peak performance. From superchargers, roof racks, exhaust kits, LED lights, and more, whether you're into speed, power, or style, eBay Motors has you covered. With over 122 million parts for your number one ride or die, you'll always find exactly what you're looking for. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, your part is guaranteed to fit your ride every time or your money back. Because with eBay Motors, you're burning rubber, not cash. With all the parts you need at the prices you want, it's easy to turn your car into the MVP and bring home that win. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to another edition of WrestleNomics Radio. I'm Brandon Thurston, broadcasting live and on demand from Buffalo, New York, where today is Sunday, January 29th, 2023. It is the day after the WWE Royal Rumble, an event that ended with what some are calling one of the greatest angles of all time. Here to join me and not talk about the content, perhaps at all, well, I'm sure we will refer to it, is Jesse Collings and Chris Scullo. Hello to you both.
I assume both of you just got done crying because the angle was so good, right? Like, you guys, are, like everyone were in tears for a long, long time, and it took you, you know, hours to compose yourself.
The people want, I think we have all seen the post-match angle, and people want to know, is Jesse Collings ready to acknowledge not only his tribal chief, but that his tribal chief is one of, is the greatest performer of all time?
Yeah, I really liked the post-match angle.
Okay.
Like, okay. I had, you know, I didn't watch it live. I watched it this morning before the show. I watched the main event and the post-match angle. And, you know, I had heard, you know, some of the very dramatic takes about it. And then, of course, some of the pushback of, it wasn't that good. It, you know,
I haven't heard any of that. I mean, I haven't looked deeply.
I mean, I've been in the depths of,
I'm
of,
sure
of,
you have.
Of the internet, Brandon.
Have you been in the depths of the AEW Freakazoid critical theory meeting?
Correct. That's where I've been. but I watched it. I thought it was really good. I thought that, you know, Roman Reigns was great in his performance post match. You know, showing a lot of vulnerability, but also showing a lot of arrogance in setting up this thing. And look, they had a huge crowd at the Royal Rumble, and they popped huge for when Sammy turned on Roman. And that's pro wrestling storytelling executed well. It makes people, I think, excited to see what's going to happen next. I think that this week for WWE, and assuming Triple H is still pulling the strings, was a really strong week from this regard, in that between Raw 30 and this Royal Rumble show, they obviously had a really big... They had a really big audience that normally isn't watching WWE.
SmackDown appears to have done a massive rating. Well, done a John Cena level number.
Right. And that's the standard for Roman Reigns, right? But I think, like, my big takeaway from this past week is, from a product standpoint, is in the past, WWE would have, like, oh, it's the Royal Rumble, a lot of casuals are watching. And they would lean on nostalgia, and they'd try to bring back a former star, or they'd have The Undertaker or Triple H or one of these guys.
No Rock on his way, apparently.
Yeah, they would have these guys who were semi-retired kind of anchor the show, and that's the kind of angle that they would shoot. Like, apparently it's the angle that they wanted to do, was something with The Rock or something with Steve Austin. Mm-hmm. But both with Raw 30, where the first whole hour of Raw 30 was basically the Bloodline story, and now the Royal Rumble going off the air with this major angle, you took what you felt like was your best angle currently going with wrestlers who are in their prime, relatively speaking, and you executed it, and you advertised that as your major thing. Not nostalgia, not something that happened 15 or 20 years ago, not this, you know, recycled storyline that you're bringing back for the 10 millionth time. They produced something that was original and new. And I feel like that's a lot more exciting, especially when you get like casual fans who maybe only watch a few times a year. They're tuning in. They're like, oh, this is something new and exciting. It's not nostalgia based. And I think that was really smart. And I think it will get people more excited about WWE, the product, over the long term, as opposed to this thing they just watch once a year or twice a year.
Right. So we're going to go over a lot of the business numbers and so forth. But first, on Tuesday, we plan to release this at 1 p.m. Eastern time on Tuesday. John Pollock and I will be talking to Abraham Reisman, who is the author of the forthcoming biography on Vince McMahon, Ringmaster. We haven't recorded that yet, but we'll be recording that soon, and we will release that on Tuesday afternoon. So look for that in your feeds early this week. If you want to participate today with a Super Chat, you can do so. If you're listening live on YouTube, we would be glad to hear your question and or comment. This program is brought to you by WrestleNomics Pitch Black Fizzy Drink. So glad that we could have that sponsor here today. We don't have the lighting ready yet because we're not quite that quality of broadcast at this point. I don't think Jesse has seen the pitch black match with the black lit neon lit. Yes.
Is it worth my time to watch the match?
It depends on what your goals are in life. If you
Knowing me, Brandon, do you think it would entertain me? Like, I would find it like entertaining to watch.
Match was not good. That match was not good. And I think we're seeing things that at least is the cage match consensus.
Cage match destroyed it.
Cage match did not enjoy this match. It's a 1.85 on cage match right now. This pay-per-view itself, PLE, if you will, only a 6.56. So pretty middle of the road pay-per-view response for this show. That said, that main event angle is, you know, getting massive praise.
Right, and that's not always factored into, like, the match rating for the main event. Like, the main event match itself, I thought, was, you know, fine. It was a WWE-style main event, which is pretty plodding and guys in big moves and guys talking in the ring and things like that. And I think everyone was just kind of waiting for the post-match, which delivered.
Yeah. So Peacock, Comcast, which is the parent company of NBC Universal, which is the entity that runs Peacock. Comcast had an investor relations earnings call. They had an earnings call on, I don't know if it was Tuesday, it was earlier this week, and they reported an update on what the subscriber count is for Peacock, and their newest count is, they round to the nearest million, apparently. It's 20 million paid subscribers. This is U.S. only. Peacock is principally only distributed in the United States. 20 million subscribers. That is up. If you look year over year, go back to, I think I actually did this math on the Q1 now that I'm looking at this chart. So I better bust out the calculator here real quick and check my math. So if I divide 20 divided by 9 minus 1, it's actually up more than double from Q4 2021. So this arrow is not correct. Anyway, a lot more Peacock subscribers have a lot more people have Peacock than have had it, I don't know, a year ago in the last, this is as of Q4, but, you know, I would assume that the reach of the WWE premium live events is larger now. That's probably going to result in larger viewership, and we're probably going to get on February 2nd, when WWE does its earnings call on Thursday, we're probably going to get more percentage year-over-year increases. No viewership numbers, I would expect. Peacock has been doing some PR graphics for the Premier League broadcast, saying they put out a number saying 800,000 viewers is what we did for this one Premier League game. So that gives you some context as far as what Peacock is capable of as far as, you know, an average viewership number. That's their own internal metrics. I don't believe that's something that Nielsen is tracking with the same methodology that they track traditional TV broadcasts with. But I guess that's, you know, it's certainly in the hundreds of thousands. Maybe it's nearly a million people that are watching this.
So would you say, Dave wrote this in the Observer, so I'm curious to know, like, do you think this past Royal Rumble, would you say this is the most highly viewed pay-per-view in WWE history from a sheer numbers watching perspective, or do you think more people would be watching? You said a million. I would assume that like the network would have more viewers when they were over 1 million worldwide for an event like WrestleMania.
I mean, W Network, when it was a direct-to-consumer service, peaked at 1.8 million viewers. It peaked at 2 million viewers when you include the free subscribers for a WrestleMania. You figure not all of them are watching it live, but I think a large percentage, probably a majority, are watching it live. So, but so that was years ago, like 2018. Mm-hmm. Now they said that the most recent WrestleMania is the most watched WrestleMania ever. So I don't know. Maybe that's as high as like 2 million, something like that.
Yeah,
is
I mean, it's still-
is this Royal Rumble going to be the most watched pay-per-view telecast ever? I doubt. I would think WrestleMania of last year would be maybe ahead of that, just because of the magnitude of the event.
Right,
but there, I think this coming WrestleMania will break that again, though.
Right, but there's a lot more Peacock subscribers.
Yeah,
than there used to be.
I would make.
And when we're talking about like casual fans or people who are only tuning in for an event like the Royal Rumble or WrestleMania, the people who happen to have Peacock for maybe another reason other than WWE are much more likely to tune into it than they would be. Certainly when it was only on pay-per-view, when they would have to purchase a pay-per-view, and certainly when it was on the WWE network, because they wouldn't sign up for just the WWE network. But if it's on a streaming service that they already have, they'd be more likely to sample the product. And now you have 7 million more people than you did during quarter one last year who have that access.
Yeah, I guess I think the new viewers to acquire are getting fewer, even if the number is going up higher. You know what I mean? Like the proportion that the subscribers are increasing is probably not. It's probably a larger proportion than the proportion of people who are going to newly watch this WWE content, because WWE content has now been on Peacock for going on 2 years here. So the people who most want to watch it, I have had 2 years to find where to go to watch it now. So I think the incremental increase is going to be a diminishing return, but still an increase, if that makes sense.
Yeah. I sent you guys an article from The Athletic, and they actually interviewed Rick Cordello, who's like the director of programming. Yeah, and he stated that WWE fans or Premier League fans are the most satisfied customers of the Peacock content. So I don't know if that shows that maybe there's a larger WWE base that subscribed to Peacock than they did the network, because there is other options. But
what does that mean, though? Satisfied, like they're the most consistent viewers? Is it a vibe thing where they feel
like... He said it was a survey, so I don't know.
They did a vibes measurement.
yeah, I mean, the Premier League, as a Premier League fan, I think the Premier League coverage on Peacock and the access to all the games is really outstanding. It's not perfect, but it's a really strong top-to-bottom service, from the content that they have, from the quality of the studio show and the analysis and the presentation, everything like that. That's a real top-notch sports product.
Yeah. So just another fact, we'll get on to Royal Rumble stuff in a second, but another fact coming out of the Comcast earnings call is that their cable subscriptions are down 11% year over year, and that in the most recent Q4 versus the Q4 of the prior year, down 11%, which is a little bit worse than the general trend lately, which has been in the sort of high single digits. So 11% seems especially high for cord cutting here. You just contrast that year-over-year change of negative 11% versus this year-over-year change in streaming, which is like, you know, more than double, going from 9 million subscribers in Q4 of 2021 to 20 million subscribers. Obviously, Peacock, that's not to say that Peacock is repairing and recovering all of this profitability that the pay TV bundle is delivering. It's not. And Peacock was supposed to be originally profitable by 2024. That's not on the horizon. They say that their peak losses are going to be this year in 2023. But that's a big thing on the horizon, is that how much is streaming going to actually recover the profitability of pay TV. I expect your streaming subscriptions are going to become gradually higher and higher over time.
Big Ten games are coming to Peacock too, so that's going to be a motive for them to, you know, possibly even bump up the price of Peacock.
Is that football as well as basketball?
I I know it's football. I'm sure basketball is involved with that, but I know it's football.
Okay. Is your smoke alarm tweeting at us again?
No, it's. I gotta get some WD-40 on this chair.
SmackDown. We have the prelim, the fast affiliate rating for Friday's SmackDown, and it's looking like this is going to be a John Cena level rating, looking like 2.6 million viewers. Were there preemptions? I think there was a preemption in the Marquette market. Anybody know where the Marquette market is?
Chicago?
It's going to be Northern Michigan, correct?
Upper Michigan.
The upper peninsula.
I heard that there was a hockey game on in Upper Michigan that took precedence over the WWE SmackDown with the Bloodline. That's the only preemption that I know of, and that sounds like a pretty small market. So there's no reason to think that this isn't the usual discrepancy between the fast affiliate and the final rating, meaning that's probably going to be, you know, the fast affiliate measured at 2.43 million viewers, and there's reason to believe that the final, which is going to be reported on Monday afternoon, is going to be somewhere between 4% and 7% higher. So that means that this is probably going to be somewhere in the range, give or take a few percent, of a 2.6 million viewer rating. So that is right in the range of the December 30th John Cena rating, with John Cena's first match in something like a year and a half. So, and that was the highest SmackDown rating since the December 2020 show with the NFL lead-in. That is, if you throw that one away, it's the highest rating since February 28th. So this is going to be one of the biggest ratings for SmackDown in the last couple of years, it looks like. Cage match response, I think we kind of went over it already. So this is, if you're interested in Google Trends, I know this is a big thing for Dave. So Google Trends yesterday. This is on Friday, apparently, but not for Saturday. If you look at Saturday, which I have up on my other screen, Royal Rumble isn't on the list for Saturday, but it is on Friday. I don't know how to make sense of that. But anyway, it's the number two most searched for topic behind Tyree Nichols, who is killed, who died after a brutal beating from police in Memphis. That underneath that, number two is the Royal Rumble with 1 million searches, is what Google Trends said. There was a Royal Rumble press conference. Did you guys get a chance to watch the Royal Rumble press conference? I did.
I only watched Triple H's part. Mm-hmm.
Jesse, did you get a chance to observe the wrestling media?
Sure did, Brandon.
Okay. My takeaways from this were, you know, so they did a bunch of things with talent, and they had Rhea Ripley and Bray Wyatt and Cody, and am I forgetting anybody besides Paul Levesque? I thought Cody came off very well and likable. I thought Bray Wyatt came off more likable to me in that appearance than he does generally. I think outlets like Fightful and Wrestling Inc. were represented. Paul Levesque took like four questions. The most newsworthy thing that he said was that this was by far the biggest live gate in Royal Rumble history. That goes back to 1988, right? This was, they doubled advertising and sponsorship revenue from their previous Royal Rumble record. Doubled it. Observer has reported that the live gate is 7 million. We'll get into that in a moment. He did comment on The Rock, certainly made it sound like The Rock is not going to be at WrestleMania this year. I just don't think it's in the cards, was the key quote that I took away from this. But, no Vince questions, notably. No Stephanie questions. None of that.
I think this was a really good week for WWE from a media perspective. I know, you know, we're only a few weeks removed, Brandon, from the incredible story of Vince McMahon bull rushing his way back into the company. And we're only 2 weeks removed from Vince McMahon settling out of court with Rita Chatterton and her civil suit about Vince McMahon committing sexual assault against her. And we're only a few weeks removed from Nick Khan doing that interview with Bill Simmons on the Bill Simmons podcast and referring to Rita Chatterton's outstanding claims of rape on behalf of Vince McMahon as an obstacle for them to overcome.
An encumbrance.
An encumbrance.
And an obstacle. Challenges and, like there are in any company.
Yes. And there was a lot of talk about like, oh, you know, will fans stop watching WWE because Vince is back or this kind of thing. And I think we were all pretty cynical about it.
Ratings are through the roof.
All it took was a couple of, you know, a nice Raw 30 nostalgia show and an execution of the Bloodline angle and at Royal Rumble. And now everyone's all back in on WWE. You know, we don't have to think about this morally corrupt company. We don't have to ask hard questions at our presser. We don't have to wonder if Vince McMahon is secretly back in charge or what influence he has on creative or if the company is potentially going to be sold to somebody like the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. We don't have to ask about that. We don't have to wonder about that because Sami Zayn, he finally turned on Roman Reigns. It's the greatest angle in wrestling history. I can't think about any of that other stuff. It's all about, you know, the moment, the vibes, the spectacle of WWE. You know, nobody does spectacle better than WWE. That's what Triple H said during the press conference. And to me, you know, it's one of those things that's sad. It's when I watched the press conference and nobody asked a question about Vince McMahon. Really, I mean, I think one person did ask Cody, like, what's it like working with Triple H versus Vince McMahon or something like that. But nobody asked about Vince McMahon actually having any creative input. Nobody asked about, like, the environment of Vince McMahon coming back to work for the company. Nobody asked about a sale, which is kind of crazy because they're pretty open about the sale. Like, that's something that I don't think you would get in trouble if you just asked about the sale.
So,
well, the biggest thing, and Tim B alluded to it in the chat real quick, the biggest thing of wrestling media journalists is a lot of them are afraid to ask the tough question because they'll never be invited again because WWE can do that. There's no governing body.
If you're not getting, if you can't ask the right questions, why do you even care about going there? Like if you can't ask the questions that you want to ask and the questions that deserve to be answered, what's the value of you being there in the first place?
Much like many of Chris Cullo's rants earlier in the week, we are up on you guys are up on your moral high horse, daring.
I sure am.
Daring to criticize powerful executives like Vince McMahon, Nick Khan, Triple H, to prove that you guys are really good people and everybody else is not. Chris Cole, I think you're even a vegan. I think that's true. Royal Rumble, they announced on the broadcast 51,000 people in attendance. According to the broadcast, that seems a little high to me. So WrestleTix, as of yesterday afternoon, WrestleTix hasn't put out a final count yet. So I imagine it's going to be a little bit higher than this, which was their count in the afternoon of 45,000. 45,275. The Observer reported earlier in the week that the gate is estimated at $7 million. So I can get to a reasonable average ticket price based on that. I can get to about $170 average ticket price based on some math around that tickets distributed number. And imagine that's going to end up a little bit higher for a WrestleTix report. So that seems believable to me that they did $7 million in ticket sales. To put that in some professional wrestling context, $7 million is more than the Wrestle Kingdom gate of about 2 million, I believe. It's more than the Full Gear gate of about 1 million. It's more than the Grand Slam gate of about 1 million. And it is just a little bit lower than the Clash of the Castle gate of 8 million, which we basically know to be a fact based on WWE's most recent earnings report where they broke out international live event revenue, ticket sales, and that was the only international event in that quarter. So... I think it's meaningful to point out that as AEW, you know, talks about its accomplishments as far as, you know, having drawn, I believe it's 4 or 5 $1 million gates at this point, which is big for them. You've got WWE doing 7 times that in one event. And WrestleMania is already, they say their biggest gate ever. Of course, that's 2 events. Versus the one event that is the record holder in WrestleMania 32, the 2016 event. So in a I guess it's ambiguous on how you want to do the comparison, but certainly in terms of a being a single day event, neither of those events are coming close to the WrestleMania 32. So Yeah, I have this table up here to show what I estimate the average ticket price was for WrestleMania last year, the 2-day event WrestleMania last year, and it looks to be somewhere between $152 and $167. So, is that reasonable that the average ticket price for Royal Rumble could be $170? Sure, that's reasonable. It's more than what I think is the average ticket price for WrestleMania, but it's not implausible.
I know. From an economic standpoint, and if you want to compare it to WrestleMania, the Alamo Dome is well known for being like the cheapest venue of that size to rent out because it's one of the only active, dome stadiums that doesn't have a major professional sports tenant. I think the old Edward Jones Dome in St. Louis is another one, which WWE I think has also run for the Royal Rumble a couple of years ago, if I recall correctly. But like, if you want to compare that to like the WrestleMania gates, those venues are much more expensive, like the AT&T Stadium in Dallas and certainly the SoFi Stadium in Los Angeles, I would imagine are several times more expensive than renting out the Alamo Dome. So if we're talking about profit, if you can draw that same sized gate at a building that's much cheaper to rent in a market that's certainly cheaper to rent than Los Angeles would be, that's another, sign of strength.
I put in a records request to the city of San Antonio, which I believe both owns and operates the Alamo Dome. Mm-hmm. And Texas has fairly strong public records statutes. So we'll see if anything comes of that. I assume take like 2 weeks for anybody to get back to me if ever. But we'll see if we get any information from that. So WrestleMania is currently, according to WrestleTix, at about 54,000 to 55,000 tickets out. 54,000 to 55,000 for each day. WWE announced back on January 9th, a few weeks ago, that they've already surpassed the gate record that was set in 2016 by that WrestleMania. And does that make sense? Well, yeah, we get to an average ticket price of about $170 again for the math to work out that surpasses the $17.3 million gate that WrestleMania did in 2016. So does this prove this? These are huge gates. I mean, like seven times Royal Rumble last night did seven times the gate of, for example, AEW's biggest show ever in terms of live gate. Does this tell us anything about the question that everybody wants the answer to? Who's a draw? Does this tell us something about the economic power of wrestling talent in the way that if we were looking at, the big event from Toronto in 1986, WrestleMania 3 from 1987, that Hogan drew those numbers. Andre helped draw that number. Paul Orndorff, he doesn't get the credit that he deserves as a draw. He helped draw that big house in Toronto. Or is it the case that these tickets were all sold before a single match was announced? Therefore, to some degree, this is completely invalid. Right or wrong?
Both. I think this is... Well, you have another slide coming, so I have a broader point.
I guess what I'm going to say is that this doesn't just apply to WWE events, by the way. Here we have, I'm going to go through a gambit real quick. AEW Revolution 2019 sold out before a match was announced on December 20th, and the show happened on February 29th, more than two months in advance. Forbidden Door was sold out instantly before any matches were announced. All Out 2021, the big CM Punk match return show, sold out before CM Punk even returned, before we even know for sure that CM Punk was going to be back and whether he was going to have a match or not, sold out. In July. He came back in August. The Ring of Honor New Japan G1 Supercard sold out before a match was ever announced. A lot of people probably believe that Kenny Omega and the Young Bucks are going to be on that show. They hadn't gone off to start AEW yet. All In, the historic All In show in 2018, sold out before a match was ever announced. So let's take a look at the biggest gates of all time. I guess what I'm starting to get at here is that this isn't just a WWE thing, but this is a thing more that is true more generally for the pro wrestling ecosystem, if you will. But I hear it applied to dismiss the the drawing power of WWE or WWE talent more so. Is it not just the case that this is a way to dismiss the drawing power of Roman Reigns, because who has main evented 4 out of the top 6 or so biggest gates of all time? If we take the top 6 biggest gates of all time, adjusted for inflation, there's one man who has main evented 4 out of those 6. He was on 5 of those shows, and he's Roman Reigns, who has main evented 4 WrestleManias that are among the biggest pro wrestling gates of all time. For those listening who can't see it, it's WrestleMania 31 in 2015 with, adjusted for inflation, a $13.5 million gate. WrestleMania 34 in 2018 with a $14.2 million gate. All these numbers are adjusted for inflation. WrestleMania 33 in 2017, $15 million adjusted for inflation. He was on WrestleMania 35 in 2019. He had a mid-card match with Drew McIntyre that did $16.9 million. And the biggest gate of all time, WrestleMania 32, is Triple H with $17.3 million. But all these tickets were sold before anybody knew this was the main event. But isn't there, I guess the key question here to ask is like, well, what did people think they were buying? And to what degree is talent worthy of being given credit for those ticket sales, despite those ticket sales being made before anybody knew what the matches were? Even though nobody knew what the matches were, people still had something in mind. Clearly, they were motivated to make a purchase. What were they motivated by? And to what degree is that related to the talent that they expected to be on the show? And does that tell us anything? Perhaps when we're making Hall of Fame votes, does that tell us anything about the drawing power of so-and-so, most especially Roman Reigns? Let's be honest here.
To extrapolate the argument, right, if we're looking at so Roman Reigns as a draw as throughout the year has a relatively limited impact on, you know, whether or not he's on an episode of Raw, SmackDown, whether or not he does a house show and pops the house or things like that. So compared to the rest of the roster, if we want to look at the Roman Reigns WrestleMania gates and all the facts that you just laid out, Brandon, the argument would kind of be like Roman Reigns is a particularly strong major event drawing card and resonates in that way, in a way that he maybe doesn't as a week to week ratings card. Like maybe Roman Reigns' presence on episode of Raw or SmackDown itself is not that meaningful to fans, but if he's in a really big, heavily promoted match, he can draw this huge house.
Just to put some other facts on the table here, for what they're worth, which we could debate. When I look at YouTube data, when I look at whose YouTube videos do the biggest numbers, not that YouTube draws a lot of money, but maybe this is indicative of something. Whose YouTube videos do the biggest numbers most consistently in WWE? Roman Reigns, if he's not number one, he's very close. When I look at Google web search and Google trends, which wrestling talent in WWE who is actually there on a regular basis is number one? It's Roman Reigns by a pretty wide margin. When I look at whose merchandise items are the top selling merchandise items on WWE Shop, if that's actually reflective of real sales, it's very often Roman Reigns in the Bloodline.
Well, I hope so. He's the only person that's been consistently pushed for the last like 7 years. So I hope compared to the rest of the roster, he would rank number one in all those categories.
So he's only up there because he's pushed in the way that he has been for the last 5 years. Wouldn't somebody else, if he was really that weak of a draw, wouldn't somebody else be doing better than him?
No, he's the only one that's pushed. What kind of argument is that? But what we're talking about here is we're talking about his impact on live attendance and his impact on gates. And whether or not the point I'm making here is that he doesn't seem to be a huge draw from attendance wise or ratings wise, and hasn't been. Now I actually start to believe that his presence is making a difference, because I think this Bloodline angle is starting to really take off. But if we want to go back to 2016, 2017, 2018, where he drew some of these huge houses for WrestleMania, his impact on a gate and his impact on television ratings was not super noticeable. But so the argument would be that he's in particularly very successful at big shows because the evidence is these huge houses that he's drawn. If we are supposing on the argument that, you know, that Roman Reigns is this huge drawing card for WrestleMania, and it's hard to deny that when he has, you know, four out of the five or five out of the six biggest gates of all time. I think this is a broader symptom of the market changing in the way WWE has approached major events, the aggressiveness WWE has had in running stadium shows, and certainly the aggressiveness across all of entertainment in the escalating cost of tickets. One of the interesting things about this chart here is that the only non-WWE events on this chart are New Japan Pro Wrestling events from the 1990s. Looks like I think three of them at the Tokyo Dome, and then the two North Korean shows, yes, which probably deserve a pretty big asterisk.
Two of them sponsored by the Democratic People's Republic of Korea.
Right. I mean, realistically, the Crown Jewel shows and the Saudi Arabia shows are all number one. But if you look at those, so the only non-modern WWE shows are these Japan shows, and that was because historically, wrestling tickets in Japan and wrestling tickets in Tokyo were the most expensive tickets in sports, or most expensive tickets in wrestling, which is why these big Japanese shows still, you know, obviously adjusted for inflation, are still amongst the top 10, 15 highest drawing shows of all time. It took a long time, and really only recently, for the U.S. market to catch up to that, for WWE's ticket prices to catch up to the prices that were set during New Japan's peak period in the mid to late 1990s. That's a factor, obviously. And also, like a lot of businesses, WWE has leaned into servicing its hardcore fan in understanding they have fans that will spend thousands and thousands of dollars on them annually. And that is why you see more stadium shows. That's not necessarily drawing fans from the local markets for these WrestleMania shows. It's understanding that you have fans that will fly in to these shows. And I think it's obviously a smart approach, but I think it's an aggressive approach that they didn't fully utilize until about 5 or 6 years ago. They could have made WrestleMania 2 days a long time ago. They could have run stadium shows more frequently than they did. Like the fact that they didn't run a lot of stadium shows during the Attitude Era, it's just really WrestleMania 17. I guess WrestleMania 18 was in, if you call that still Attitude Era, but you know, the fact that they didn't, when they probably could have run more stadium.
19 was in Safeco.
Right, WrestleMania. Yeah, those aren't Attitude Era shows. I'm talking about more like that peak,
yeah,
you know, Austin Rock period. Right. Granted, Austin Rock were on WrestleMania 19, but you have these, I think WWE has leaned into that more. I mean, you've seen this happen in other industries. Disney is big on this, right? In the last 10 years, Disney has really understood that they have a rabid fan base of people who will go to Disney World multiple times per year, and they have this whole economic system set up to service those people. WWE is the exact same way, which is like, I think, you know, that was part of Nick Khan's plan for last year, which is we're going to run a bunch of stadium shows to see if we can continue to get people to fly to events once a year, not just WrestleMania. Now they'll fly to the Royal Rumble. Now they'll fly to SummerSlam. Now they'll fly to Money in the Bank. Well, maybe not that, but they're trying to see how big of a fan base that they can get and how much money they can get from those people, which is a smart strategy. It's led to these big gatehouses, but is it really reflective? How much of that is reflective of, well, they have a huge star in Roman Reigns and everyone wants to see him, or how much of that is in a business model? Could John Cena have drawn?
But I mean, like, they're buying tickets for wrestling matches. They're not buying tickets to see. Like, if you advertised a card that, I don't know, had no matches or had a bunch of wrestlers nobody had heard of, you know, like, I'm trying to parse this talent's not a draw, but the brand is a draw. Clearly, the talent matters. Like, the talent may be a bunch of spokes on the wheel who are more replaceable versus Hogan's era, but they clearly matter to some degree.
Oh, they certainly do.
I was just going to say, do you think it's the brand, the belief in the brand equity that makes them acceptable of Roman Reigns draw? Or, oh, we know they're going to give us. It's like the expectation, like WWE never fails. So they're, you know, they see Roman Reigns as a great talent because it's WWE presenting him. as a great talent. Like, I mean, you saw this in years when guys would go to TNA and they just wouldn't get that same type of buzz that they did in WWE. It's like, oh, he's with WWE, he's a star.
And I think there's a seal of approval that comes with WWE and being associated with that branding that makes you come across like a star. And I think Roman Reigns' star aura, and I thought he did a great job last night, and I thought he had that star aura. But he has that star aura because he's been pushed and put on this pedestal compared to all of his peers for the last 7 or 8 years. It's not just because he's such a dynamic performer. It's because the entire weight of WWE's creative focus is behind every single one of his actions. And there's no real way to replicate that in any other wrestling promotion because WWE has that brand awareness and has that monopoly on the imaginations of fans in a lot of cases. So,
yeah.
I understand the argument, Brandon, that you're making, which is that to some degree, the wrestling talent does matter in that the fact that people know, maybe they're buying tickets before the show is announced, but they know that they're going to be getting Roman Reigns and Seth Rollins and Becky Lynch and all these other names. And if it was just a true mystery box of a card, if it's WrestleMania, nobody knows who's going to be in the main event. It could be Roman Reigns. It could be Tony Mudd. Like, it could be any of these people. It could be anyone. That's obviously not the case. People are buying WrestleMania tickets because they think that Roman Reigns will be there. They think that, Seth Rollins will be there. They'll think Kevin Owens and Sami Zayn and probably some, maybe Undertaker makes an appearance. Maybe The Rock or Steve Austin is there. I mean, Steve Austin was there last year and he antiquated himself pretty well. So, maybe he will, pop up again this year. We don't know that. So I definitely think there's some value in saying that, there's trust in the brand and there's trust in the roster that WrestleMania is going to be a show worthy of my time. So it's not completely to be dismissive of the impact that talent has individually on Gates.
I think when it comes to Reigns, and to a lesser extent, his predecessor, John Cena, there's an opportunity cost in how they were promoted. I think there's... I am open to an argument. I don't know if I'm making the argument, but I'm open to an argument that that Cena and to a greater extent Reigns are, they were a means to create a lot of good economics. But there was a great opportunity cost in the way that they were pushed at the expense of getting other talent over who could have also contributed to a greater net economic value. And I think, I don't know. I think it's complicated, and I think Roman Reigns is within wrestling discourse is often the victim of criticism that more rightly, at least, goes to Vince McMahon for his choices and how he chose to promote Roman Reigns. What does that say for? Okay, so taking that into account, what does that say for how big of a star, how big of a draw is Roman Reigns? Maybe he's in some ways comparable to somebody like Bob Backlund, where you can make the argument that anybody could have been in Bob Backlund's spot. They would have drawn just as well. And it took Bob Backlund a long time to, for example, get into the Wrestling Observer Hall of Fame. So I don't know. I think if maybe others could have done similarly as well as Reigns, but I think you could say that about a lot of people in almost any walk of life and a lot of different endeavors, not, beyond wrestling. If so-and-so was allowed to, if Uncle Rico was allowed to start at quarterback, he would have won state. but there's,
he can throw a football over the mountains.
Over the mountains, he can. It's ultimately this, sort of argument about opportunity and the tension that has with actual results, which...
Well, how about this is just a very, very, very small sample size and more of a theory than anything backed up by evidence. But on Raw on Monday, the Raw 30 show, that you knew that you were going to have a big audience. They spend the first hour just hammering home the bloodline angle. Long segment, the trial of Sami Zayn. Didn't really make any sense, but got over with the fans and people enjoyed it. And then you had the match and everything like that. You put an angle that you feel like is hot and your best thing. You put it out there for the 2.8 million viewers who were tuning in to watch. There's Uncle Rico right now. And then we look at this. So that happens, right? You get this big audience and they're consuming the bloodline. They're consuming this thing. And then what happens on SmackDown this week? Looks like they did a really, really good rating. Why is
John Cena there? No.
Yeah, why is that? They didn't really have Hulk Hogan, no Undertaker. It was a very ho-hum episode of SmackDown. There wasn't really a ton promoted for it.
Right.
Could it be that because some people tuned into Raw 30 and they saw this Roman Reigns and Sami Zayn angle and they said, oh, this is pretty good. Like, or, you know, maybe I'll check out SmackDown this week, see if they follow up on it.
And whatever happened there didn't translate to NXT. And maybe that just makes sense because the NXT talent is completely different.
Yeah. And are the people who are sampling Raw 30, the first Raw they watched, the first Raw they watched in a year, are they even aware of NXT? But they're probably aware of SmackDown. And the point I'm making,
commentators are aware of NXT.
And the point I'm making here is that's pretty unusual. Usually we see these nostalgia shows, they do a big number, and then next week they're right back to normal. That wasn't the case, at least from this transition from Raw to SmackDown. And is it partially because for the first time in a long time, WWE focused on current talent and focused on, you know, trying to create a new star, at least in this case in Sami Zayn, and to like a lesser extent the Usos and Solo Sikoa. But they actually focused on contemporary stars and are pushing a current angle, and that was front and center, as opposed to a DX reunion or something like that. And so I see positives coming from that end, and that's something that they haven't done for the last several years. And you talk about like the cost of opportunity, not just with Roman Reigns, but also this insistence on focusing on the past instead of building towards the future or focusing on current talent, and how that has had a negative impact on the company's popularity.
Okay. I hear the rating when W does a big rating like they did on Monday, and I hear the narrative that they did this big rating, and people who usually don't check out the show checked it out, and then the next week the rating went right back to normal. I think that's an argument that is enforced often against WWE, and it's also sometimes enforced against AEW. And I think it's the same argument. It's not a particularly strong argument in my view. It's like saying that, hey, look, remember on October 2nd, 2019, when AEW Dynamite was actually watched by 1.4 million viewers, all those I can make the same thin narrative that says, hey, all those people checked it out, and guess what happened the next week and the week after that? A fraction of them tuned out and never came back. And I can say the same argument about when Rampage had its second show ever and CM Punk made his debut, and all those people who usually don't check out the product checked it out, and guess what? The ratings went down. And that proves my intuition, purportedly, that, look, they checked it out, and that product that I just happen to also have some problems with, that product turned people off. And it's the same sort of psychology, just with a completely different taste of wrestling installed into it. And I think so here's the thing. Those arguments just don't account for the way that people consume media today, which is to say, people talk as if, okay, the number was 2.344 million viewers. They talk as if all those people watched the whole show, and they discreetly watched it and then didn't watch it. What actually happened is, more people watched it, yes, and more people probably watched a greater percentage of the show than they do normally. Or what we're actually looking at is a number that is the average minute viewership of a 3-hour program or a 2-hour program or a 1-hour program. And we talk about it as if it is this very simple wholesale binary thing, which it is more complicated than. And it doesn't account for the way that people of different ages, especially younger ages, tend to watch wrestling more occasionally, and more they will watch it live if it is something important, seemingly. And what do we see when we see a big number like this go up? It's 18 to 34 that's up, not P50 plus. Okay. Anything else to add there? Okay.
The future is a hefty responsibility, and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
What else do we have here? If you want to contribute your own thoughts, feel free to add a super chat, which we will handle by the end of the program today. An update on what we may call the Luchasaurus mask lawsuit. If you didn't see the report, we talked about it on Thursday, and I have a report that is free for everybody and ad-free on WrestleNomics.com. An organization called Composite Effects LLC, or CFX for short, which is a mask designer, among other things that they do, they made a mask for Luchasaurus. which they claim to be a copyrighted work. Luchasaurus was allowed to use it in their view on live events. He was not allowed to use it in their view in merchandise. So Composite Effects LLC is suing AEW and Austin Madison. Austin Madison is the real name of the performer who performs as Luchasaurus. Here's the actual work that they're claiming is a copyrighted work, which they call the Viper Silicone Mask. And we had a question that Gullo brought up last Thursday. Wait a minute. Wasn't Luchasaurus also on Lucha Underground? Wasn't Luchasaurus also in Ring of Honor? How come Lucha Underground isn't being sued? How come Ring of Honor isn't being sued? The issue here that Composite Effects is getting at in their legal complaint is that this is about merchandising more than anything else. This is about the fact that Luchasaurus and that mask are being marketed in t-shirts, in action figures, in COVID masks even, and that is an infringement on their copyrighted work, they say. So that's what's happening there. I don't know if I have more to add to that, but and by the way, this is a different mask apparently that he's using in Lucha Underground. We have an image of it up on the screen here. It's noticeably a different mask, and if you actually look at the complaint, it says that Manelson worked with CFX in December 2016 to create that mask that is at issue in this lawsuit that presumably Luchasaurus is wearing in AEW. His appearances in Lucha Underground were all earlier in the year in 2016, which means they were taped even earlier than that, because as we know, the Lucha Underground tapings would happen well in advance of when those episodes would actually air. So this is probably a very different mask, and I don't know this is a mask that was even created by Composite Effects LLC. And the issue with Ring of Honor is, at a minimum, that mask was not merchandised by Ring of Honor, apparently.
How would you compare this lawsuit to the Randy Orton tattoo lawsuit?
Yes. So I don't know that I didn't follow the Randy Orton lawsuit as closely as I'm following the only document that we have for this so far, but I don't think that the tattoos were claimed to be copyrighted works, which is what they're claiming here, is the mask is a copyrighted work.
Right. The argument was that the tattoos are licensed. The argument was that they were licensed artwork and that it was appearing in this video game and they were not being compensated for it.
I'm not sure what the whole argument is, but it's interesting.
Slippery slope lawsuit in the sense that many athletes and famous people appear in video games with tattoos. And if we have to compensate the tattoo work of every tattoo artist who has done this work, there's probably going to be no tattooed athletes.
I think there are still filings being put out for that lawsuit. But the latest that I heard was that there was a settlement, but it was a pretty small amount of money. It was like in the tens of thousands of dollars, mm-hmm. which at this point, I'm sure a lot more has been spent on legal fees. So, yeah. I don't think that Luchasaurus, just to repeat what we said on Thursday, I don't think that Luchasaurus is off of TV because of this. I wouldn't expect – I saw people on Twitter responding to the story saying, oh, my God, they're going to take the mask off of him because of this. I don't know anything, but I doubt that that's going to happen because this – AEW clearly knew that this was an issue – according to the emails that are a part of this complaint. AEW knew that this was something that had to be addressed to some extent while Luchasaurus was appearing on TV going back to 2021 at least. That's when they had this other mask produced that they did buy the rights to but then ended up not using. So AEW has been at least aware of this apparently for quite some time while Luchasaurus has been on TV. I believe that he is injured right now and that this legal issue is not related to why he's off TV right now. So if you're a big fan of Luchasaurus' mask, I wouldn't expect his mask to suddenly disappear. I suppose he could start to wear a new mask as a result of this, but maybe it's just more likely that this thing gets settled in some fashion.
He was also just kind of written. I think he had his big blow-off match with Jack Perry. And we've seen in AEW that can happen to guys, certainly like monster-style wrestlers who Tony Khan doesn't like to beat that often, that they can be off television for a long period of time.
Yeah. Plug for the WrestleNomics Patreon, patreon.com/WrestleNomics, where you get the TV reports nearly every day. We just had, in fact, the other day, yesterday, I reported on New Japan viewership, impact viewership, which we're going to talk about in a moment. If you want the WOW ratings, that's where you get them, is the WrestleHonks Patreon, as well as core hours for WWE shows and AEW shows, access to all the big data, access to the slides that we're using right now, and things of that nature at patreon.com/WrestleNomics. The Wrestle Kingdom airings on Access TV for New Japan for a couple weeks here did at least bigger demo numbers than Impact did at a more favorable time slot. Of course, Impact airs on Access TV 8 to 10. I mean, this is a network that's only in about half the cable homes, so you keep that into consideration when we're talking about these viewership numbers. But Impact, in the year now that New Japan has been, joining Impact in this block from 8 to 11, Impact has always had higher viewership than New Japan, except for January 12th, where they had the same viewership as Kenny Omega and Will Ospreay had their match that was aired on Access TV that night, had the same total viewership. You can't see the difference in the demo rating here, but if you broke it out into viewers, New Japan did beat Impact in the demo. The following week, New Japan did beat Impact in the demo, again by a slim margin, but had closer, had not equal, but had pretty good TV viewership in terms of 79,000 viewers. This week, the first week was Omega and Ospreay. The second week was Kazuchika Okada and Jay White from Wrestle Kingdom. The third week, again from Wrestle Kingdom, it was Keiji Muto's big match, his last match for New Japan, but it only did 51,000 viewers versus Impact, which did 93. So we're back to normal is the moral of the story here. The New Japan, Keiji Muto could not keep the streak alive.
I thought the most recent episode also had the Sasha Banks segment.
Oh,
yeah.
Don't tell a Sasha fans that.
Because the Keiji Muto thing wasn't an hour long.
Okay.
That was an hour-long match, so there was other stuff on the show.
I did not see the episode.
I'm pretty sure they had the woman, the Stardom title match.
Okay.
And then obviously the Mercedes Moné debut. Okay. I think the recent weeks have been reflective of New Japan getting a little bit more buzz back in the American market, obviously coming off of Wrestle Kingdom with the Kenny Omega Will Ospreay match and the Mercedes Moné debut. Kind of put them back in mind, so it's not surprising to see the viewership bump up, especially when they were airing stuff like the Will Ospreay and Okada match. It'll be interesting to see if they can continue to at least be competitive with Impact, if we're using that as a standard. It's unclear, is Access happy with the New Japan numbers?
They renewed New Japan recently, so I imagine that it was like a one-year deal, and in the last few weeks they announced that they have been renewed.
Is New Japan still on the Roku channel?
No, I was just going to ask that, yeah.
All the people who watch New Japan on Roku, I'm surprised we're not hearing about it. I would expect so, but yeah, somebody could pull up Roku real quick and take a look. But those are the line charts. I guess in terms of year over year, we're going to... New Japan is going to be down year over year at the moment, 65 to 77. From January of last year. And I think that's against reruns when they were airing episodes that had already aired previously on Access. Anyway, that's New Japan. I did some quick analysis on the WWE NIL program. They announced the third class of NIL recruits. So we're up to 46 NIL recruits. These are college athletes who WWE is signing to some sort of contract. And they may or may not end up training at the Performance Center to become WWE superstars someday. And I just wanted to look at what sports are they recruiting from here. And for men, it's mostly football. 14 out of the 25 men that they've recruited to the NIL program are football players. Five of them are in track and field. Five of them are in wrestling. And one of them is in both football and basketball. For women, it is more assorted. We've got 7 track and field athletes, 5 basketball players, 2 volleyball players, and then a handful of other sports, including, they got 1 recruit for the following: wrestling, tennis, softball, soccer, and cheer and dance. So I guess it's not that surprising, but it's interesting to look at. Oh, they are really focusing on football players among the men.
They want big guys, Brandon.
Oh, I love it when people are tall. And the average height, I did the average height of the NIL recruits for men. Your average height is 6'4". The average height for women is 5'7". They have as people as tall as 7 feet, as tall as 6'2" for women, but nobody under the height of 5'11" for men. Nobody under 5'3" for women. So
we're going back to those days.
Take care of the short demographic. But we're going to get some tall people in here who can
draw. Who would you say is the most over wrestler right now on WWE's roster? Just like the guy who the fans are into the most.
What do you mean by on the roster?
The full-time active wrestler. Right now, who would you say like is the fans are the most into? They're excited to see them when they come out. Gets the biggest pop, whatever.
I think Reigns.
But all right, besides Roman Reigns. Right. Sami Zayn, I'm assuming because look at this stat. Sami Zayn, he's got to be what, like 6'6", 6'7"?
He's not short, right?
He might be like six feet.
I think he's right at 6 feet, yeah.
According to Google and probably Wikipedia, his height is 6'1".
Yeah.
So
that sounds about right.
Minimum height here for the NIL recruits. He's not a short man.
Yeah, I guess that's true. Are any of the NIL recruits, so the NIL, like, as you described, it's WWE sponsoring these athletes who are current college athletes. WWE is paying them to be endorsed WWE and to kind of the idea is for them to consider WWE after they finish their athletic endeavors.
Yes.
Do we know have anyone that they have signed to these NIL deals? Have some of them actually, you know, formally started training at the Performance Center?
I was thinking about that. So the NIL program was first, they announced their first class of recruits in December of 2021.
Mm-hmm. So some of those athletes have graduated from college.
I did not look into that, but that was a question that briefly crossed my mind. But I don't know. I don't believe any NIL recruits have started training, as far as I know. I haven't heard about that.
Yeah, you would think that would be at least somewhat publicly presented, which is like,
I don't know what grade or what class. Have they recruited seniors already who are done with college at this point? I don't know. Yeah, December.
I would think if they started by 2021, by 2023, someone would have been graduated by now.
It did cross my mind to be like, hey, where's the output here? Gable Stevenson is one, obviously, and he's been training, I think, but he hasn't had any matches, obviously.
Radio silent on what's going on there. Well, was his brother an NIL recruit though, or is he just signed after he graduated from college?
I don't think he was an NIL recruit,
right? Because he's been on television and wrestled and things like that. They have, I mean, it's one of those things that's like we talk about the NIL recruit, and WWE would certainly like people to think it's like a magical new idea, but they've been for generations they've been recruiting big college football players to wrestle for them. Some of their biggest stars have been that
Roman Reigns.
You look at the roster.
Aaron Corbin.
You look at the NXT, and right now, like who's on NXT television? A lot of those people are former college athletes and football players. They maybe weren't part of the NIL deal, but they're it's the same idea. They're going out recruiting
Brock Lesnar.
I mean, John Cena, college football players are
West Texas State, all Steve, that class, all the alumni.
Steve Austin played the Rock. Yeah, I think Mick Foley was the only one that didn't play football, but he was an amateur wrestler. I think
The Undertaker was a basketball player. Obviously, I think Kane was also a basketball player.
Kevin Nash,
Triple H didn't do anything.
Bodybuilder.
Yeah. There's no bodybuilding.
Triple H and Kenta Kobashi, two guys who came into wrestling after doing bodybuilding, no sports.
Mm-hmm. I heard Hulk Hogan was quite the little league player.
Yes, guitar player too. He had a background in entertainment. I think you guys wanted to talk about this. Michael Mulvihill. Does anybody know who Mike Mulvihill is? Do you know who he is other than somebody on Twitter?
He's a reporter, isn't he? No, I don't know him. You're right. I just see him as a Twitter personality.
He's like a, I don't know if he's an EVP or a VP of research for Fox. Fox Sports, but he works for Fox. Mm-hmm. But he tweets a lot of Nielsen data facts and things like that, but not a reporter. He puts out the question, per Nielsen data, what was the most watched scripted entertainment show of 2022 on linear and streaming combined based on total watch time in the United States. This is in reference to a report that Stranger Things is the most streamed show of 2022. But what's really the most watched show of 2022? I pulled out my spreadsheets. I got into the ratings Ryan / spoiler TV reruns because I knew it had to be a rerun, right? That just plays endlessly on TV. But Yellowstone did come to mind. I kind of tried to look into Yellowstone. But it's not like Yellowstone is playing all the time. They do get a lot of really strong live same-day viewership, and they do have some reruns, but it's not a ton. As far as the reruns that make the top 200 weekly list, it's led by, The Big Bang Theory, but also Friends. That was my guess, was Friends. But I was wrong. It's not Friends. Something even more surprising.
Acknowledge Sheldon Cooper. Acknowledge him.
Is it Sheldon? Is Sheldon the correct answer?
Yeah.
No. It is Gunsmoke. Gunsmoke, the TV series that aired, I believe, from 1955 to 1975, according to Michael Mulhill, aired over 3,000 times across multiple networks. I don't believe it's in any of my rerun data that I scraped from Spoiler TV. And it amassed 113 billion minutes of watch time. He does mention that Friends was number two. But
I can't think of a cable network that's even on. Like, it would be on one of those like throwback TV things.
I'm
like,
almost skeptical.
It'd be on. So it would perhaps be on TV Land, which is what I associate with. Yeah. First of all, acknowledge Marshall Matt Dillon as
is that the main character?
Yeah. I bet it's on a lot of. I bet it's on a lot of those My TV.
Yeah, throwback, retro. Syndicated, yeah.
Like, but those local syndicated. They're in a lot of homes, right?
Those channels between the channels. When you're
yes,
2.2, 2.4.
A lot of channels that WoW is probably on. That Gunsmoke is on. And the olds watch the most TV. Particularly retired people watch most television. And obviously this is a show that would appeal to a very wide demographic of older people because the length of the show that it was on from 1958 to 1970. So it's a part of a lot of different childhoods. And there's a million episodes, so you can just keep watching them and watching them and watching them and not see repeats all the time. It's interesting statistical anomaly, I guess, when it comes to talk about like what is capturing our culture, what is capturing our pop culture versus what are people actually viewing.
And I wanted to point out, while we're on the subject of old people watching TV, I'm searching for it right now to get the exact number, but the playoff games, the NFL playoff games that aired last week, sorry to bring up a sore subject, call, but the average age of the NFL viewer last week, which I imagine is just an example of what's normal. Here it is. This is according to Sports TV Ratings, at Sports TV Ratings on Twitter. The median, so women love football too, yada yada. The gender split was this. The median age, and I don't know if this is one of the game or the other, but I imagine this is representative. The median age for NFL last week was 53.4. So even the stuff that is the most watched on all of traditional TV, NFL games, has a median age in the 50s. That tells me that, okay, just TV in general is being watched with a median age of somewhere around that number. So when we look at these median, and people lose their minds when I post these charts that show like the median age of wrestling TV programs, and some of them tend to be older, like NXT and Impact and New Japan, getting into the 60s. I mean, we were just looking at the table a moment ago showing New Japan and Impact has a median age in the high 50s, in the 60s. It tops out at 65 and just stops for some reason. And it's hard to wrap your head around, but I think that's just the state of traditional TV viewership, is that it is very, very old. Hard to imagine half of the people watching New Japan over the age of 65. That's hard for me to imagine, but that's what it measures at. And it's not like the NFL is being watched with a median age of 35 or something like that. So just something to keep in mind here. And we have a few questions. If you want to put your own question in, we will take it in a moment. We have. Have you heard about the coming lineups for WWE on A&E? Has anybody heard about that yet?
No, I have not. I haven't seen it posted anywhere.
I know they did a new Treasures, but that's it.
So starting on April 9th, and I don't think this has been reported elsewhere at this time, but there will be a 6-episode run of W Legends Biography. I think there was a promo that I saw last night on during the Royal Rumble with Steve Austin featured, and he was putting over Superstar Sundays coming soon to A&E. Of course, they've already done a couple seasons of Biography, the Legends Biography. But A&E will be again airing a new program starring Stone Cold Steve Austin, which at the moment is titled Stone Cold Takes on America, which will have a 10-week run that will begin on April 9th. That will follow, I believe, a 6-week run of Biography episodes on W Legends, including the likes of Dusty Rhodes and the Iron Sheik, China, and people of that nature. So Stone Cold Takes on America will have a 10-week run beginning April 9th. That is the Sunday after WrestleMania weekend. So there's that. That is new news. And if the news aggregators would listen to WrestleNomics, they would now know some new information that they could perhaps report. But anyway, maybe there are other podcasts to listen to instead. I think we're all done. We can go to super chats if there are any. I think there's a couple.
Yeah, we just Urka just sent us a super sticker, so thank you, Urka, for that. And then we have a super chat, more of a comment from Bob the Builder. Cody entered the John Cena space in the scrum. His words, cadence, and poise walk the impossible line between cheerleading and talking credibly.
Yeah, I thought he came off very well. I would say he came off more authentic than John Cena comes off, I would say.
Yeah, I think John Cena often comes across, like, for a John Cena who's an extraordinarily charismatic person, like on camera, I always found him kind of very boring in these kind of settings. Cody's a worker. Cody knows how to use words, and he knows how to talk. That's for sure.
Not sure what his opinions are on Taiwan, but nonetheless, I think he did very well. Anything to plug?
No. I mean, the Gentleman's Wrestling Podcast, my podcast, we just had a new episode that came out on Friday. You can find that right on YouTube. You can also go to my Twitter to find it out. I did a Q&A. I got about a dozen questions from people asking a lot of questions about AEW, Warner Brothers Discovery, a lot of questions about Ring of Honor, a lot of questions about like New Japan and AEW's working relationship. I went over those. So that's on the Gentleman's Wrestling Podcast. You can find that right on YouTube.
Okay. Golo, anything to plug? Golo's living a different timeline. Okay. Thanks to everybody for listening and subscribing, if you do subscribe. We'll be back. There'll be a podcast in your feed on Tuesday with our interview with Abraham Reisman, the author of Ringmaster, of course. And that interview will be with John Pollock and me. And we'll be back on Thursday for subscribers with a WrestleNomics. Actually, no, we won't be, probably, because there's an earnings call. So that's what's happening here. Yeah. Tuesday, there'll be a podcast in your podcast feed with Abraham Reisman. Thursday, there'll be an earnings call. So I don't expect, unless there's some huge news coming out of the earnings call, which I doubt there will be, I'll be doing that on Thursday evening. And then on Friday, John Pollock and I will do a talk about the earnings call that will be in your WrestleNomics feed and your post-wrestling feed. So look for all that coming soon. Thanks, everybody.
We got a last-minute super chat real quick. Delmar Abdi, last-minute super chat right in the buzzer. Wild prediction on the SmackDown demo, over under 0.7.
It's a simple math problem. So I guess if I think it's going to do 2.6 million viewers, then I think the demo is probably going to account for about a third of that. So 884,000 viewers in the demo. Now, if you divide, you got to get the ratings. So you got to divide that by the universe estimate. And I don't know what I'm looking at here. 884 divided by this is 6.7. So under about a 0.68 for the demo is what I expect. 0.68. So that's less than 0.7. Under. Okay. Thank you
for the very specific.
I also think under.
Okay. Thank you for the very specific demo question, Delmar. Always appreciate it. Talk to you next time. Bye.